Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
With me today at Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, is a very special guest. Ron Hosko is the president and member of the board of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. And Ron had a very storied history as a law enforcement officer. He joined the LELDF in April 2014 after retiring from a 30-year career in the FBI. And he held a number of assignments, was awarded the FBI's Shield of Bravery for his actions during a violent ransom kidnapping. He was promoted to the Senior Executive Service and served as an inspector. And he oversaw the Washington Field Office Criminal Division. So he's had an amazing amount of experience, and now he runs the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. Ron, thank you so much for being on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. Welcome.
It is my great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it is a pleasure. And, you know, your name came up during a conversation with a police officer, and he was telling me about the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. And I had heard about it at one time during my career, but didn't really pay much attention to it until I started looking into the work that you do. And this is vital stuff that every police officer should know is out there. Would you mind going on and explaining exactly what the LELDF is and the mission?
Sure. So the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund is a nonprofit, really for a beneficial purpose, public purpose, and that is kind of threefold. One, for over 20 years, the organization really started by a handful of just a couple of people to look at cases where the principals here thought that a police officer has been charged with a crime in the performance of their duty or for the performance of their duty, usually a case involving the use of force. And the media kind of takes hold, bends the message, and it's where the board thought the officer is not getting their due process rights or not getting the benefit of the doubt or the presumption of innocence, and that they should not have been charged for the case where they were. So almost always it's some form of use of force. And then after I got here, almost 3 years ago, I thought that in the wake of Ferguson and actually leading up to Ferguson, that there is a lack of good information out there about, what a police officer goes through in the performance of their duties, how these typically use of force decisions are made, the dynamics of that. And so we undertook this other secondary mission, which is to kind of inform and educate the public. Very often that comes in the form of educating the media. After Ferguson, we heard gross misstatements of what had happened there. This was as the investigation was going forward from the media. We thought somebody's got to correct the record and educate journalists, media representatives, on the difficult decisions, use of force decisions that police officers have to make. And we got a police training simulator and installed it in our office and started to invite members of the media in to train them, to educate them, and then put a weapon, simulated weapon, in their hands and played a bunch of scenarios so that they got a sense of what it's like to make these decisions yourself before they criticize or armchair quarterback what a police officer did in the heat of battle. Try walk in their shoes just for a moment in a simulated environment. So those were the two big pieces of what the organization has been doing, raising funds and trying to help individuals who we think are wrongly charged, and then educating the public.
That's a hell of a mission. And let's talk about the first part of what we were discussing.
Okay.
That is the t- taking police officers who have been wrongfully accused of use of force, and generally speaking, you're talking about you're not talking about minor uses of force. You're talking about where shootings have occurred, where people have been have lost their lives or been seriously injured. Correct?
That's right.
I was on your website. I was looking at some of the cases that you have taken on. Mm-hmm. And first of all, let's a little bit of history. How long has the Legal Defense Fund been in existence?
We're approaching 25 years. It really started in the wake of the Rodney King incident in Los Angeles, where, as I mentioned, a couple of our my chairman and another gentleman thought that the whole story is getting bent in the reporting. These police officers are not getting a fair shake at justice, and they went out with a direct mail campaign to try to raise some funds and help Stacy Kuhn out there, the sergeant on the scene,
right,
and some others to pay for an effective defense. And they were overwhelmed by the response, and then it just struck them that, hey, there's something bigger here that we should be thinking about and doing. And they started this 501c3 organization, nonprofit, to help other officers that are having similar battles. And so fast forward, you can see some of those officers on our website just in the last couple of years, where our success from in court has been overwhelmingly positive. That is, you know, we're smart about the cases that we look at. We have an intake and a vetting process where we are trying to understand, is there a political dimension to defending a particular officer? Very often, you know what that political dimension is in our society today. It's race.
Yes, of course.
Where very often the officer, like the majority of officers out there, is white, and the person they used force on is not. And it takes on a life of its own. We saw that in Ferguson. I've experienced that since I've been a part of the organization. But we take our vetting very seriously. We want to know what's the officer's use of force history, what's their disciplinary history, what were the exact circumstances in the case. And we circulate the information to our entire board, which I'm happy to say includes luminaries. Ed Meese, former Attorney General of the United States. Brad Reynolds is a former Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, both under Ronald Reagan. There's a number of former FBI executives on our board. And we all deliberate on each and every case and decide whether we should take it or reject it. And we use as our barometer the seminal Supreme Court case on how we should evaluate force decisions with police. And that is the case of Graham versus Connor, 1989 case, where we use their language to say, how do we judge this officer? Well, they should be judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene rather than with the 2020 vision of hindsight, and recognizing that officers have to make split-second judgments and decisions in circumstances that change very quickly. So we have that guidance from the Supreme Court in mind with every case that we're taking on. We're not... typically we're not looking at cases where a police officer responds to a barking dog call and asks a resident to quiet down their dog. And if the resident says no, police officer takes out their gun and shoots the person. We could all agree that that's unreasonable.
Right.
What we're seeing is cases where a police officer is trying to effect an arrest, where it may be dark out, where there may be an attempt to flee, or there's a fight, there is a strong belief that there's a weapon involved, or the weapon is a vehicle, and the police officer may be run down or being dragged, or a vehicle speeding at them. And so we kind of see that, and truly where the officer may have a second to make a decision, may have a half a second to make a decision, and that is a fateful decision for them, because we've learned in this line of work that that officer's life, first, I've never worked with a police officer who gets up in the morning with the idea in mind that I want to take somebody's life today. I have this gun. I have this power given me by the police. I'm going to take a life today because I want to. I've never worked with a cop with that mindset. In fact, quite the opposite. You know, every police officer I've ever worked with, and that includes federal agents as well, are out there trying to make somebody else's life safer or better. And suddenly they're thrust into a scenario where force is very likely to be used, and deadly force might be necessary to resolve it. I've certainly been involved in situations, both myself as an investigator and as an inspector, where I've seen officers and agents use deadly force because they thought it was required based on the circumstances, and then it turned out that their belief in the subject of that force, you know, posing an immediate threat to them, was wrong. Agents trying to arrest a bank robber, and they're hollering, you know, show us your hands, show us your hands. And the bank robber puts their hands down to their waist as though to go for a weapon. They shoot, and the subject was throwing out a bag of dope. Or chasing robbery offenders down the street and saying, get on the ground, show us your hands, show us your hands. And instead, the offender is reaching into a pocket where a weapon in this scenario might logically be. And it turns out after they shot and killed him, it was a cell phone.
Right.
And it's exactly those circumstances that are defined by the Supreme Court's language. And so we look to that, and we look to the political environment that is in the town or the locality where the incident occurred, and say, you know, is a prosecutor making this decision based on political factors outside of the guidance of the Supreme Court? And the answer is, very often they are. And so we look at those factors influencing a case, and because I think judges and jurors see that influence too, the cases that we have undertaken routinely get dismissed, or the trial occurs and a judge hearing that case throws that case out or says, you know, not guilty. The officers are acquitted.
Right. And on your website, you have a list of some of your high profile cases, and mm-hmm. one in point that is very well known to the law enforcement community is the Baltimore Six, the police officers who were arrested by the prosecutor in mm-hmm. Baltimore.
Perhaps Randy, the clearest of the cases that we have, although I can talk about others. A subject, Freddie Gray, known to the police in that community for his many arrests, typically drug related, flees as he spots the police sergeant on the scene, who's observing a known drug location. Gray is fleeing the scene. He's run down by two bike officers who catch up with him. He's taken into custody, starts to create a scene. Of course, a crowd gathers. It's Baltimore. And they put him in a wagon. They later adjust how he is restrained in the wagon. And when they get him to a booking facility, Gray is unresponsive. And the best evidence, really, I believe, and I think a judge believed, was that during that transportation, Gray is thrashing around in the back of the wagon. There's another subject who was later arrested and put in the other side of the police wagon. He gives the police his version of what had happened. And interestingly, that other subject, that other detainee, is uninjured. he's riding in the same wagon as Freddie Gray, who's thrashing around in the other side. And that other detainee is completely uninjured. And of course, when the information about Gray's arrest and the fact that he dies later at a hospital a day or two later with a severe neck injury, when that is made known, Baltimore ignites, and there's rioting. There's millions of dollars in property damage, over 100 police officers injured, and you have this. I think it would be fair to say arrogant, rash. As you know, I think you could make the case unhinged. Chief prosecutor Marilyn Mosby, so egocentric. That she engages with Vanity Fair for a profile of her, you know, profile of in courage of Marilyn Mosby. She decides, even though the police department is conducting an investigation, she kind of pushes their findings to the side and decides to charge these six Baltimore police officers for, you know, I don't want to say she threw the kitchen sink at them, but depraved heart murder. That sounds pretty darn bad, right?
It sure does.
And all the way down to misconduct in office charges for failing to seatbelt Freddie Gray into the back of the van. And that's in the wake of this rioting that these officers, six officers, are indicted. And if you're one of those officers, your career, certainly your financial situation, your family situation, psychologically, emotionally, you're changed forever.
Absolutely,
because that accusatory finger is directed at you, and that was the case of these six officers. And we were contacted by the Fraternal Order of Police, who initially said, "Hey, we have these guys covered." Then they realized how hugely expensive it was going to be to defend the six in court, asking for separate trials. They're entitled to that. And over the course of the next year and a half, as the media wrote stories about the six and about the events, the reality played out in Baltimore. And that reality was far different than what Marilyn Mosby and a lot of the citizens that were, you know, calling for public execution of the six.
Yeah.
It was far different than what they had presupposed, which was going to be, you know, quick and easy convictions, successive convictions. They would fall like dominoes, and then they would be subject to, you know, the most heinous of punishments. And the reality was, when the truth started to play out in the courtroom, and myself and a couple of my colleagues went up for several of the trials, the truth was something different. And the truth was that Mosby and her prosecutors could prove none of the allegations that they had made, that as the trials were playing out, they were shifting their strategy from one that suggested, you know, really that the police had, you know, gone and done something physically themselves to harm Freddie Gray, to, well, that he probably got a rough ride in the back of the police wagon. And when the video started to be played out, you could see, at least in a couple of occasions, the van driver, who was the one accused of depraved heart murder. Oh, by the way, Freddie Gray was black, and so were three of the officers.
Right.
That the van driver, who was accused of depraved heart murder, had taken some wide turns. And as you know, a wide turn would give you a softer ride, not
exactly
a rougher ride.
Exactly.
And so the reality that played out in that courtroom to a judge who, by the way, also African-American, who had come from, in the past, the DOJ Civil Rights Division. So if we're thinking in racial terms, who would be most likely to convict these officers? One would think a black judge. Right. And the judge dismantled Marilyn Mosby's case brick by brick by brick and acquitted officers in successive cases up there because there was no case to be made. And you know, if I could suggest to your listeners, you know, pull the transcripts of those cases and just look at the judge's findings. He dismantled the cases. He made a mockery of indictments brought by Marilyn Mosby. And because of his language and because of how he dismantled those cases, it, you know, for what they were, which was wholly lacking in evidence that would support the convictions, she had to go back and then dismiss the final charges against the remaining officers because she knew she had a loser. She should have known, she should have done her job at the beginning as a prosecutor and looked at the evidence before rushing to a judgment. And this is the core of our mission, is these cases where a prosecutor, thinking they're going to get some personal advantage.
Right.
And I'm sure Marilyn Mosby had great things in mind for Marilyn Mosby's career.
Absolutely.
Instead of looking at the reality of the evidence, she took the political path, which was let's find a tree, let's get a rope, and let's hang these guys quickly. And it didn't play out that way. And in fact, you know, those cases turned out to be an embarrassment, probably certainly devastating to her career. Calls for her to step down. We were making those calls. Now there's claims by five of the six officers against her in court for malicious prosecution. Good. There should be. Because it's the job of the prosecutor to look at the evidence and look at the law in an unbiased light and not be driven by local politics, not be driven by calls for police heads, but do really what a brave prosecutor, like one down in St. Louis, did in the wake of the case that has changed policing forever, and that's Ferguson, Missouri.
Exactly.
Do what a brave prosecutor is going to do, which is look at every piece of the evidence. He did that, and he and his grand jury did not bring charges because no charges were merited, because Darren Wilson did what any police officer would do in that case, which is initially fighting for his life against a much bigger man who assaulted him in a marked police vehicle, sitting in uniform. Somebody who Darren Wilson tried to shoo out of the middle of the street to avoid disrupting traffic or being hit himself. And instead, Michael Brown turned on him, tried to wrestle with him for his weapon as he sat inside his police vehicle, and then turned back after he was shot once in the hand, turned back to attack the officer a second time. It's outrageous, but a courageous prosecutor pushed aside some ridiculous public sentiment and the national press and found the facts and said, I'm not bringing charges against that officer.
Darren never got justice. He was very fortunate that they did not take the political route and run him through the criminal justice system as well. But still to this day, he is facing lawsuits and is still, I mean, he was the victim of the Ferguson mess and the Ferguson lies.
I totally agree that truth was the victim, because if you were to run a poll across America today, I'm sure you would get a ridiculously high response that would suggest that Darren Wilson was the wrongdoer down there.
Right.
And people who think that Ferguson was some sort of an injustice, well, it was, and I agree with you totally, Randy, that it was an injustice to Darren Wilson. It was an injustice for policing, because police since that time have been cast in the shadow of what happened at Ferguson. And now we're hearing reports, and this is something my organization tries to address as well, is we're hearing reports. We heard it, I guess, a year and a half ago from Jim Comey and from others about the Ferguson effect and police officers in America pulling back from that kind of discretionary, marginal policing that we need from them to keep cities safe.
Right.
And now, and of course, Jim Comey, you know, the director of the FBI, was very quickly criticized by voices in the White House and the DOJ saying he doesn't have the data to support that.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? Now, what Comey was hypothesizing about, what he was concerned was happening, is now being proven to be real. And look no further than the results of a Pew Research poll that just came out, oh, maybe a month or so ago, where 72% of the officers polled, and this is in bigger departments, departments that have over 100 officers, 8,000 cops were polled, and 72% said they were less willing to stop and question someone they see as suspicious because of what's gone on since Ferguson. 76% reluctant to use what they believe to be appropriate force because of what's gone on since Ferguson.
Right.
93% are more concerned about their safety. That is what Jim Comey was talking about, a chill wind blowing across law enforcement. That is the classic Ferguson effect. You look in one of the deadliest cities in America today, the city I used to work in 20 years ago, and at that time it was deadlier. Chicago, Illinois. And you see an 80% decline in street stops by cops in Chicago at a time when murders are rising at an incredible rate. It is a scary city, parts of it, to live in, the South and the West Side, and cops are pulling back. Why? Because they fear the second-guessing of the media as much as they fear the assassin's bullet on the south and west side of Chicago.
You know, let's delve into this just a little bit because, of course, as you said, Ferguson was a watershed moment for law enforcement, and we are seeing the effects of it dramatically now with the facts. And the facts are that cops are depolicing. Some call it Ferguson effect. Some call it depolicing. But the result is the same, and that is that the streets are less safe for law enforcement officers and less safe for citizens because of the Ferguson effect, which was in essence a media fueled activist driven false narrative that has taken hold of people's opinions about law enforcement, and it's almost become some type of hysterical reaction, which is now affecting every aspect of the lives of law enforcement officers.
Absolutely true. I saw it. My reality is, after 30 years in the FBI, I thought I was going to retire to, you know, a fairly quiet little nonprofit and try to raise some money to help offset the massive cost of defending some police that I thought and my board thought deserve more, deserve better. And 4 months later less than 4 months later, came Ferguson, this encounter where the lies of a witting liar by the name of Dorian Johnson, I think he's witness 101 in DOJ's lengthy report, took to the street corner to tell an alternate reality of what had happened down there in the encounter between Michael Brown and Darren Wilson. And his lies were transmitted by a witting, welcoming press, because it tied directly to their narrative, which is heavy-handed, race-driven cops using excessive force against a black underclass, and there was no challenge to the lies. And the lies ignited a brush fire in America that started in Ferguson and spread. And it spread very quickly to the East Coast and to a place that was right down the street from where I used to work. And that place was 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in the form of Barack Obama and his attorney general, Eric Holder, who were very willing to, you know, follow up on this proposition. In fact, Obama had done it before. He did it up in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Exactly.
He did it after, of all places, a memorial service for dead Dallas police officers.
It was shocking. Shocking.
It was shocking. It was despicable. He gave the police, who had come for a memorial service for their fallen friends and fellow officers, a lecture. And the lecture was essentially, you should have expected this because you're all racists.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, it was despicable. It was grossly out of place. And but that's what we were getting from the White House since 2009 in this encounter up at Cambridge, you know, that involved his friend, Henry Gates.
Right.
And he immediately chose sides against the police, you know, suggesting early on the police acted stupidly. And then, you know, like we do so often now, let's roll the tape. And we went to the video and we heard what was coming out of his friend's mouth. And it put things in a different light. And one would have thought that the president would have learned from that experience. that maybe I don't jump right into these waters, because these waters can be murky, and maybe we ought to let the facts come out. And he did it again in Ferguson, dispatching three White House representatives to the funeral of Michael Brown, who was, I think, clearly by that time known to be a strong-arm robber of a local convenience store, menacing the store owner. I think it looked to me like an assault of the store owner on his, or a shopkeeper on his way out. And then someone who, and this is a felony, assaulted a uniformed police officer in a marked police vehicle and wrestled with him for his weapon. That's someone who, in this president's estimation, deserves three White House representatives at his funeral.
It was absolutely, I mean, debilitating for American police officers to watch that and to see that. It was demoralizing to the entire profession.
Understandably, the police were reeling from it, because this is someone who, the White House was willing to turn into some sort of false martyr. For what cause? For the cause of assaulting shopkeepers, taking what you want, assaulting the police? That's a martyr. And in fact, we saw the extension of that martyrdom when Michael Brown's mother took to the stage at the Democratic National Convention as part of the Mothers of the Movement. It was outrageous.
It was outrageous.
It's the narrative of the left that is anti-cop and promoting some sort of victimhood theology that is a false theology in many cases. And that's not to say that America shouldn't be a better place. But, you know, unfortunately, America's police, who are the front line, who are the first line, who are the face of government to a lot of folks, who do come running when you call 911, they're not going to be able to fix so much that is broken in American society, and that is the family, that is the failure of religion to pull people in and to motivate them to be better, the failure of our educational system, the poverty and despair of the inner city, and the lack of economic opportunity. The police don't get to fix that. And by and large, the police aren't going to fix mental health issues either, mental illness in America. But that's who comes. That's who shows up. And so I don't think there was the appropriate recognition. I am frankly, I was heartened last year that we had a candidate running for president who, at every campaign stop, stopped to recognize the sacrifice of America's police.
Yes.
Good for him. Good for him. And that was not what we were hearing from the other side. We weren't hearing that from the Obama White House. You know, he was busy welcoming in the likes of Al Sharpton and Black Lives Matter. And Hillary Clinton, in her embrace of anything that would help her get elected, was also willing to do the same.
It was to watch her pander to Black Lives Matter and to the other quote activists unquote was nothing short of embarrassing, if you will.
It was embarrassing, and I guess maybe now we can kind of ponder among ourselves, you know, wonder what she's doing today. We know what she's not doing. And you know, was that one of the many things that hurt her candidacy? I don't know. If it was, I'm glad, because imagine where we might be going with Hillary Clinton as the commander in chief. I think now at least we have a president who does recognize the tremendous sacrifice of the men and women in law enforcement, and he needs to look no further than the Secret Service agents who are surrounding him, many of whom were working through the campaign without days off, without any kind of overtime pay for all the extra hours that they were working, and still committed to doing their job. Well, you know, that extends to the hundreds of thousands of people in the uniform of the American law enforcement officer who do the same thing. They sacrifice day in, day out. And so that we have a president who recognizes that, good. That's a good starting point.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. It's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. We invite you back to AmericaOutLoud.com to get all the latest. Make it a daily stop and also get the app. You go right to the App Store and download our free app, and that will put all our content right into your hands on your phones and your tablets. It doesn't get any easier than that.
Do you actually assign attorneys, or do you pay for attorneys? How does that work?
Well, assign, no. Mechanically, typically these cases, we don't have notice in advance that a particular officer is going to be indicted or charged, and so it's up to them to go get an attorney. And then what we do is once we agree to support the case, then we will engage with the officer and their legal team to try to raise funds. And we do this through direct mail, a tearful letter that might arrive in your mailbox that says, look, here's the situation for Officer Mike Brelo in Cleveland, or Officer Dominique Perez down in Albuquerque, or Rick Combs in South Carolina. They have found themselves charged. We try to appeal to hundreds of or thousands of potential donors, tell them the story, and see if they'll donate $25 or more to help out this officer in this situation. And then, to the best of our ability, we'll try to offset those bills that those attorneys are generating. The reality is, depending on where you are in the country, to defend a police officer in this environment can be hugely expensive. Many of these officers, they will never be right again financially, even if they prevail. And in our cases, we very often do. We had a great batting average last year where, except for one case that ended up in a mistrial in favor of acquittal, every other case the officers prevailed.
That's amazing. And that's a hell of a record.
Well, we don't say yes to every case. There are cases that, we wish the officer well. We hope that they get a good defense, but the case isn't for us, and we will tell them no. So we're guided by this language of the Supreme Court. We look very closely to say, look, was this kind of a one of these decisions where the situation was very dynamic, all of these factors are at play, and the officer did what they thought they had to do. I'll give you one example, and there's many examples on our website. The case of a single man police department, Officer Rick Combs down in South Carolina. I inherited the case. It started in 2011 before I got to the organization. And the officer was in his office. A person who had an arrest warrant came in to change a court date for his daughter. He had an obstruction warrant, and the officer told him while he was sitting in his office, and the man got up and fled to his pickup truck with Rick Combs in hot pursuit, on foot, hollering, call for some help, because he was a bigger man than the chief. And when they got out to the man's pickup truck, the man opened the door, got in, and Combs met him there in the apex of his open door. And he was trying to prevent him from starting his pickup and fleeing the scene. And the man was able to get his pickup started, put it in reverse, and hit the gas. Now the chief is hanging in the door trying to figure out how far am I going to be drug under this pickup truck.
Right.
And he made the fateful decision to shoot. And it was fateful and fatal. And he was charged with misconduct in office in 2011. The prosecutor there in South Carolina did nothing to move forward that case for 3 years. And then we had an event in Ferguson, Missouri, and there was another incident in New York where the police officers ended up in a struggle with a much larger man, and he died on the street. His name was Eric Garner. I think you remember the case.
I would say I do.
Right. And so with those two cases hanging in the air across law enforcement in America, then the prosecutor in South Carolina said, take a guilty plea or I'm going to charge you with murder. That's just 3 years later.
Wow.
What drove that? Well, Eric Garner and Michael Brown drove that. And sure enough, he was true to his word. Of course, Rick said, I'm not going to take a guilty plea. And he was charged with murder and run to trial in the following January. Very quickly, after doing nothing on the case for 3 years, now I'm going to indict you for murder and I'm going to take you to trial in 2 months.
Well,
that's exactly what the prosecutor did.
During that 3 years, had the chief been suspended?
He was suspended because he was charged with a crime, misconduct in office.
So
a misdemeanor.
For that 3 years,
a misdemeanor.
He's not employed.
That's right. That's right. He's in limbo. He is in professional limbo. He's in legal limbo.
Oh my God.
He's in emotional limbo. He's in financial limbo. Because imagine what a small town police officer makes in a little town in South Carolina. So goes to trial, mistrial, hung jury. Prosecutor says, I'm going to try you again. 6 months pass.
Jesus.
To trial again. Mistrial. Right? He says, I'm going to do it again. And imagine the difficulty. Now, here's the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund trying to raise some money to fund the defense of a week-long trial. Even in South Carolina, that's expensive. And so we're trying to keep up with it. And because of the potential cost, and we said, look, we can't pay up front for a third trial. We raise money over time. And because Rick Combs is out of money himself, long out of money, he takes a guilty plea to the original charge.
No.
Not because he thought he violated the law, but because he can't pay for his defense anymore.
Oh, my God. This is...
Right. And so that's what we face, because of politics in America, not because the man did anything wrong. He did what any of us would do in that circumstance. Or I guess you have an option. Fall, be drugged by the pickup truck, potentially to your death. Make a decision. And make it within a second.
Jesus, Ron, I was hoping you were going to give me a happy ending on that.
Yeah. Well, the happy ending is for Rick. Rick was on house arrest for a year, and he's trying to put the pieces of his life back together. As is any officer who, is because they've been charged with a crime, they're going to be suspended, many of them without pay.
Yes.
And so we have these cases that come, sometimes very quickly. And even if a judge decides to throw the case out, which we've had repeatedly, look at the case of Mike Brelo up in Cleveland. He's in a chase where a dozen other police officers are firing their weapons too. Mike Brelo is the one who's charged. And, it made the news, in both of these cases, we're talking about, and frankly, in many of our cases, we're talking about somebody who served our military honorably. Mike Brelo is suddenly in the center, at the epicenter of, the gunfight at the OK Corral.
Yeah.
Where 140 some shots are fired. He's in the middle of it, fires his own weapon, had served his country honorably in Iraq, and now is being charged with manslaughter. And fortunately, a judge listens to all the evidence and dismisses and finds Mike Brelo not guilty. That's great. But imagine the cost of a weeks-long trial, the fame and the ignominy of, how that impacts your family, that they're seeing their father on trial for his life, facing 20 years in jail.
Right. Yeah.
Acquitted. Hey, it's great. It's great. But then having to fight to get his job back and get back pay for doing what any other cop. And when I did a segment on CNN, they said, how is it that you're defending Mike Brillo? And I said, I look to the Supreme Court language. I look to the Supreme Court language that tells me what he should be judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene. And to me, my starting point is, what did 12 other officers do on the scene? They fired. They fired their weapons. That's my starting point. That's why I'll defend Mike Brillo.
Exactly.
Right? Well, but it changes their lives forever.
I couldn't agree more. Do you guys at the Legal Defense Fund, so you pay for the attorneys, do you also offer expert advice or get expert witness testimony for those
cases?
We do.
We have a number of experts that we've used. We used one gentleman who's a former FBI use of force expert. He's written some books on it. He's now heading towards retirement, so we're kind of taking him out of the lineup. But we will try to offset the cost of the legal team, which includes either recommending potential expert witnesses or trying to offset the cost of those expert witnesses as well. You know, one of our frustrations is this, Randy, because we can only take on a few cases at a time because we typically raise funds through direct mail, and that is cumbersome. It's very costly. You know, it's paper, it's printing, it's postage. And so we do the best we can to offset the cost. In some cases, we're lucky because the costs don't mount. They're not, seven figures. They're not high six figures. And we can, offset those costs. And sometimes the officers walk away and they owe nothing. But in too many of our cases, the costs grow and grow and grow. And so we can't offset them all. And we'll tell the officers and their attorneys right up front, we're going to do the best we can, but that doesn't guarantee you're going to have no debt at the end of this thing. Because, you can't predict, is there a trial? Is there a mistrial, a retrial? How often, how many of those, how many cases we have? So we tell them straight up, we're going to do the best we can to make you come out of this, financially whole, but we make no guarantees. We are depending on our audience that gets this through direct mail. We're trying to do some other fundraising as well. We're depending on them, and they may respond to it and be brought in and say, hey, here's a big check. Here's a lot of little checks. In some ways we're like Bernie Sanders, $29 at a time.
Right. I hear you. One of the other cases that I saw on your website is that officer. I mean, when I read what was going on with this guy, I just shook my head. This is that Hoskins, I believe his name is.
Josh Hopkins.
He was on that television show, Southern Justice.
Southern Justice. He was. Tune in. You'll like him.
I've had some conversations with him, and this is another one of those cases where years later, after his shooting, there's all kinds of political intrigue going on, and he suddenly finds himself under indictment for murder.
Right, right. And some of these, I'm glad you brought Josh's case up. He goes by the nickname of Hoppy. He has this big, lovable teddy bear. If you've seen Southern Justice, I think it's on Nat Geo. I saw a piece of an episode, and you can't help but like this guy. And he goes to response to a call with other deputies to a known troublemaker, somebody who's drinking and running around, shooting off his weapons and tormenting neighbors. And they encounter him, and he was on this form of probation where he's not to be drinking and he's not to be in possession of weapons. And I think he had actually surrendered a bunch of weapons to police. And when they encounter him, he has been drinking, and there is a rifle on the passenger side seat of his pickup truck. And when Hoppy sees, this is at night, of course, making the situation a little bit more concerning. They spot this rifle sitting on the passenger side of his seat in his pickup truck, and they tell him, "Don't touch anything. Don't move. My the other deputy's going to come around and put that rifle somewhere where it's a little bit safer. And with that, the man puts his pickup truck in reverse and jams on the gas, kind of dragging Josh Hoppy with him, because he reaches in to try to prevent him from starting his pickup truck. Again, you know, it harkens to the Rick Combs case that I'm talking about, where he's now tangled up with this guy and being drugged by his pickup truck. And as the man backs up, Hoppy kind of stumbles to his feet, and they're hollering to him, "Don't move, don't move." And what does he do? Then the truck starts rolling forward at Hopkins, and he and the second deputy fire their weapons at him. The third can't do it because I think Hoppy is kind of in the line of fire, and Josh's rounds are fatal. He strikes this man fatally, and finds himself now charged and facing decades in prison in this small North Carolina, Western North Carolina county. It is outrageous. I don't know if that prosecutor would have preferred that a deputy been run over by the pickup truck, and then we could have said what a tragedy that was. I'm not sure what result. Now, there's reports that prosecutor was friendly with that driver and his family, and then he brings in a second prosecutor quite clearly with the notion of prosecuting the case, and Josh Hopkins finds himself charged and facing decades in prison. It's outrageous. It's wrong. In that case, both Hopkins and the offender, that's who he is to me, were white, so there's no racial diversity here. This is, to me, the case where a friendly prosecutor was taking care of his friend, and his friend is deceased, and he's going to charge the deputy who did it. This is the Hopkins case for us was an easy call. There is no way this case should have ever been charged. You look at the language in Graham versus Connor. You look at the dangerousness of this person, the fact that he had defied the court orders that he was under for probation to not be drinking and to not have a firearm in his possession, and he was doing both at risk to his neighbors, and then putting at risk these deputies who responded to the scene.
And that case is still going on, correct?
It is ongoing. Yep, we expect probably movement in both in that case and in another new case this year. A female police officer outside of Milwaukee who's been charged.
That's the one where the guy was on Angel Dust PCP, and it was
he wasn't. There was I don't think that there was any drugs in his system, although he certainly acted it. But you know, we're talking about a mammoth man who was three times the size of this officer, who decided to defy the police and resist arrest, and ended up in a struggle with the police on the ground, and she discharged her weapon. He's alive. He was shot and you know, seriously injured, but recovered from it. You know, now she finds herself charged with a felony. Thought she was in the fight for her life and for her partner's life.
Outrageous! Outrageous! Yep. Well, you know, so how can people help you? How do my listeners help you?
Well, they can certainly go look at the cases that we are defending. They can read and hear some of the media pieces that I've done on these cases and others on our website. We are, if they search police defense, they can find us on the internet, www.leldf, Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund.org, or policedefense.org. They can find us, they can find our cases, and they can donate right on our website if they're inclined to help us.
Blue Lives Matter is the largest grassroots police support organization in the country. We have approximately 1.4 million followers on Facebook, and if you're not one of them, you need to go to our Facebook page and make sure that you like us and follow us. We also have the news and information website, bluelivesmatter.blue, which tells you everything you want to know about what's going on in the world of law enforcement, timely news stories, and programs that we are running.
End of watch.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we honor those men and women of the law enforcement service who have lost their lives in the line of duty. This week, I have one name to read. Deputy Sergeant Kevin Haverly of the Greene County Sheriff's Office in New York. Deputy Sheriff Kevin Haverly was killed in a single vehicle crash on Route 23 in Ashland, New York at approximately 6:15 a.m. He was returning to the agency's satellite office in Ashland at the end of his midnight shift when his patrol SUV left the roadway and struck a utility pole. Deputy Haverly had served with the Greene County Sheriff's Office for 4 years. He is survived by his wife, 3 children, mother, and sister. End of watch, February 28th, 2017. May you rest in peace. Thank you so much for listening in to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement with your host, Randy Sutton. Each week we try to bring you some interesting, newsworthy comments and stories about things that are important to law enforcement and to the supporters of law enforcement. Once again, thank you. Be safe. See you next week.